say our topic for tonight is the life and spirituality of St. John Vianney, who lived from 1786 to 1859. So he's known as the Curé of Ars. The word curé means a curate or the pastor. And Ars, spelled A-R-S, is a little tiny town. And in fact, it's not even on this map, but it's not too far from Lyon, France, which is sort of in the southwestern corner of France, not too far from La Salette and from Grenoble. So tonight we're going to look at St. Jean-Marie Baptiste Vianney. Now, it's interesting, he's one of the 15 male saints that have Mary as his middle name. You know, there's Louis Marie de Montfort and many others, but there's 15 male saints within the last couple centuries that have the middle name named after our Blessed Mother. And so I'd like to first start out with talking about his birth and childhood, and then talk about his studying for the priesthood, how he became a draft dodger. You might not know about that. That's an interesting story. It's always through no fault of his own. And then talk about how he went to Ars and he worked there for 41 years. And then at the end, talk about his, throughout the whole talk, I'll talk about his spirituality. So let's start first of all with his birth and childhood. He was born on May 8, 1786, in a place called Dardilly. It's near Lyon in France. That he was born and he was baptized on the same day. They didn't waste any time. He was the fourth out of six children. His mother, his name was Marie. His father's name was Matthew. They were a poor family. His father was a very hard-working farmer, but also a very generous person. He would often put travelers up, sometimes as many as 20 travelers at a time. He would house those who were passing through. He was also known for his almsgiving. And so his father was a very generous man, but also a very stern person, somewhat of a hard-working farmer. Now, at the time that St. John Vianney was born, again, it was 1786, and it was 3 years before the French Revolution. The French Revolution was from 1789, and it lasted, especially the Reign of Terror, for a good number of years, and really for about 10 years, the effects of the French Revolution were not only affecting Paris, but other parts of France as well. As a young boy, St. John Vianney was able to go to daily mass until just 1791, the civil constitution of the clergy was enacted, which meant that the anti-Catholic government that took over France was bitterly anti-Catholic and made every member of the clergy sign the civil constitution, saying that they were going to take an oath to the state over the church. And the priests that were unwilling to take this civil constitution of the clergy were guillotined. And during the height of the French Revolution, over 2,000 Catholics were being killed each day in the streets. So they say the streets of Paris ran red with the blood of the martyrs. And so because of this, the churches, even in other parts of France, were closed as well. So, and many of the priests were either exiled or killed, and many of the Catholic schools were, the majority of Catholic schools were closed and turned into state schools. And even in his own parish of Dardilly, the church doors were closed and locked, and all around in the area of Lyon, there remained about 30 faithful, loyal Catholic priests that continued to work in disguise and in secret to spread the faith. The two most famous ones were the Abbe Bally, B-A-L-L-E-Y, and the Abbe Grabos. Now, Father Bally, who became the mentor and the tutor of St. John Vianney during this reign of terror and during the difficulties, acted as a carpenter. And so he carried on a carpentry business, but in his free time, he would go around saying mass, hearing confessions. And of course, if he was caught, he would have been most likely executed. And Father Grabos, the other great priest, was working as a cook. And so they were incognito, in disguise, and they would go around saying secret masses, and the Vianney family were known for sheltering these good holy priests. And so here was young John Vianney, only 3, 4, or 5 years old when this occurred, and he could see the great love, the great zeal of these priests, and that is something that I think God used to inspire him to the priesthood. The French Revolution also tried to change the calendar. In fact, instead of having a 7-day week in which you keep Sunday holy, they changed it to a 10-day week. That's one of the hallmarks of a revolution, is try to overthrow tradition, try to change things so much that it would confuse the people and stamp out any form of real spirituality or tradition. So they tried to change the course of the week, but the Vianney family kept the old calendar and kept worshiping God on Sunday, even in secret, and keeping Sunday as a day of rest and as a holy day. Well, as a young boy, he was the favorite of his mother. And his mother, he says that next to God, he owed his Catholic faith to his good mother. He once said that virtue passes readily from the heart of the mother into the child. And his mother taught him how to make the sign of the cross, that even at 15 months, he could make the sign of the cross on his own. And at 18 months, he would join in listening to the family evening prayers. And so his mother was a great inspiration to him. And whenever he talked about his mother later in life, he would always have tears well up in his eyes. And he said we should be so grateful for the faith passed on, especially through the mother. Well, as a young boy, he received very little formal education because the Vianneys would not send him to any of the state schools. And the Catholic schools were closed at this time. And so John Vianney worked on the farm, worked as a shepherd, taking care of cattle and sheep. And from an early age, he was taught the love of God and the love of our Lord and the Blessed Mother. When he was 4 years old, his mother gave him a little statue of the Blessed Mother, which he cherished. He even sort of kept it close to him as he slept at night. That's an interesting story also. When he was a little bit older, maybe 8 or 9 years old, he was working in the fields with his brother, and his brother was bigger and stronger and could plow a lot more territory, and poor John had a very difficult time keeping up with him. And so what he did was he had a case made for the statue of the Blessed Mother, and so when he saw the row he had to plow, he would take the statue in the case and throw it as far as he could in the direction that he had to work, and then he would plow as fast as he could to find the statue. And then he would, you know, kiss the statue's feet and then, again, throw it again as far as he could. And he said by doing this, he kept up with his brother. And so he he was developing his spiritual life quite a bit. And whenever he heard the church bells chime in town, he would say a Hail Mary. And he was frequently praying throughout the day. Well, during this time of the persecution of the church in France, there was such confusion that he was unable to make his first confession until he was 11 years old. And he didn't make his first communion until he was 13 years old. And these were administered to him in secret by Father Gregoire. Well, then in 1799, when St. John Vianney was about 13, Napoleon became the absolute monarch in France. And because of that, even though Napoleon was really no friend of the church, he did there was more order established, and the churches were allowed to reopen, and masses were again said publicly. And now St. John Vianney was able to visit the Blessed Sacrament before he would go off to the fields to plow, and in the local parishes in Écully, which is where he would attend, he was able to go to Mass and confession on a regular basis. Now, because of his lack of formal education, he really only had about 2 or 3 years of formal education. He could just read and write, but nothing else besides that. And yet the seeds of the vocation to the priesthood were planted in his heart, and he asked his father if he could become a priest, and his father said no. He said, no, I need your help around the farm. You know, you're a big help, and we need you here. So he was unable to, for at least 2 years, pursue the priesthood, but then at the age of 19, his mother was able to convince the father that, you know, we really should not stand in God's way and let him become a priest. And so he went off to talk to the Abbé Bally, Father Valley, who is the pastor at Akulli, who had sort of an informal seminary in his rectory. And so he was helping a lot of young men to pursue their studies for the priesthood, even though it was not a formal seminary. He would at least teach them Latin and philosophy and theology and about the saints. And so Giambiani was able to begin his studies at age 19 for the priesthood. And Father Valli was a little bit reluctant because Giambiani was just not too well educated. And yet after Father Valli talked to him about the saints, he realized that St. Giambiani knew sacred scripture, he knew the saints so well that he was very impressed. And he also sensed that Giambiani had great common sense. He was really willing to study hard, and he was a young man of prayer and of penance. And so for this reason, Father Valli really took a shining to him. And really, if it wasn't for Father Valli, we would have no St. Giambiani, as you'll see in just a few moments. One of his most difficult crosses at this time was his scholastic ability. He especially found Latin to be almost impossible, and he would try as best he could to study and to learn. In fact, sometimes somebody once told me that when Giambiani had to take a test, he knew he could not study the whole chapter in Latin, so he just picked a paragraph, and then the rest of the time he spent praying that this would be the paragraph he would be asked to translate. I tried that a few times in the seminary myself. It didn't always work. Well, he was getting more and more frustrated because he felt that there was probably no way that he could become a priest. And so he made a pilgrimage, a 60-mile pilgrimage on foot to the shrine of St. John Francis Regis, who was a Jesuit missionary in France. And he, along this way, begged for food and shelter, and when he got there, he spent a few days there in prayer. His main prayer was that through the intercession of St. John Regis, that God would let him become a priest. And he felt strengthened and comforted in the fact that he felt that no matter how difficult it would be, that he would be able to eventually one day become a priest. Then in 1807, he received a sacrament of confirmation, and he took the name Baptiste after John the Baptist as his confirmation name. He was confirmed with 3,000 other young people. And after he was confirmed, he did feel a renewed strength in his spiritual life, and he did a little bit better at his study. Well, then another cross entered in, and that was Napoleon was in desperate need of soldiers to go off to the Spanish front. So then in 1808, there was a draft. And even though Giambiani should have been exempt from the draft, his name was not on the exemption list, and so he was called up to serve in the army, in Napoleon's Grand Army. But after he was called up for this, he was ill, had two serious illnesses, and then when his regiment was sent off to Spain, he was delayed, and he then had to try to catch up to the regiment. And so there he was carrying some of the gear and praying his rosary. And because of his illness, he was still quite under the weather. He was at a point of exhaustion, so he stopped by the side of the road, and he knew that he couldn't catch up to the regiment that night, so he didn't know what to do. And all of a sudden, the fella appears, a Frenchman named Guy. So never trust a Frenchman named Guy, because he was an interesting character, all right. He did give Giambiani a place to sleep that night and fed him. And then the next morning, Giambiani was ready to try to catch up to the regiment again, and the fellow said, you know, there's no way you can catch him. You might as well stay here with me. This fellow was a deserter from the army. He was a draft dodger. And so he told Giambiani, if you try to catch up, the police will see you on the road. They'll arrest you. You'll be thrown into chains. So Giambiani really had no other choice, he felt, than to more or less wait out in hiding for the next couple years until things settled down a little bit, because his unit had left without him. And so he decided to just go higher up into the mountains, a place called Les Robins. And there he was sort of adopted by a widow and her four children, and he became known as their cousin, and under a different alias, and he taught them to read and write, taught the children, even some of the adults he was able to teach to read and write in that locality. He taught the children their catechism, and even later on, years later, people were so impressed by his holiness and the example he gave to everyone, both adults and children alike. Oftentimes, the police would come and looking for deserters, and he slept out in the barn underneath a pile of hay. And there were many times when, you know, the policeman's pitchfork almost came right through him, because they were looking for him, not for him in particular, but looking for deserters. And he says a few times the pitchfork almost went right through his chest, but our Lord preserved him from that fate. Well, then in the year 1810, Napoleon granted a general amnesty, and he released any deserters from any kind of punishment. And so then, after a few years there, at the in this particular location of Les Robins, he was able to leave. And before he left, the people knew that he was off to become a priest, so they made him a beautiful cassock and made him wear his cassock, and they wanted to see what he would look like as a priest. And so then he journeyed back home, and he returned to Dardilly in 1811, and there, fortunately, his mother was still living, so he got to spend a few months with his mother. And then she died on February 8th of 1811. And after her death, he really felt detached from the things of this world and continued to pursue his study for the priesthood. So now he was 24 years old, and so he went back to see Father Bally and to find out if Father would accept him back into studying for the priesthood. And of course he did. And later on, John Vianney wrote that it was really, if it wasn't for Father Bally, John Vianney would never have been ordained. And apparently Father Bally was quite a saintly person. John Vianney later on in his life said that he met many beautiful souls during his life, but the most beautiful soul he ever met was the soul of Father Bally. His father, this priest, was a man of great prayer and devotion and kindness, as well as a man of deep spirituality, prayer, and penance. So then, after some more time with this mentor, the Father Bally sent him off to the seminary in Verrières. And so he studied a year of philosophy there. A very difficult time he had, but at this point, this was 1813, and here St. John Vianney made the total consecration to Jesus through Mary, according to the teachings of St. Louis de Montfort that we talked about last week. So after he did this, he received again great strength and renewal and a certain inner peace that, even though the struggles were there were many, he felt that God would still call him to the priesthood. So then after a year there, he was sent off to the major seminary in Lyon with 250 seminarians. And he was known there for his prayerfulness, his penance, and his simplicity. But after 6 months, he was dismissed, and he's asked to leave the seminary because of his studies. So he went back to Father Bally, and Father Bally still wouldn't give up. So Father tutored him for 3 more months and sent him back again to retake the exams for the priesthood, and he failed again. That's because all the tests were given in Latin, and he just had a very difficult time with that. So then Father Bally sort of scratched his head and says, what do we do next? You know, he's failed. He's been kicked out of the seminary. I sent him back. He failed again. He says, I know what I'll do. I'll go talk to them myself and see if the professors will examine him in the faith in French. And so they came to Ecole, and they asked him all sorts of questions, and he did very well. And then they had to go to the archbishop, and they said that, Archbishop, we have here an interesting situation, because here we have the most unlearned and yet the most devout seminarian we've ever come across. You know, should we ordain him? Or are you willing to ordain him? And the bishop said just three things, asked three questions about him. He said, is he pious? And they said, yes. Does he have devotion to Our Lady? And they say, yes. Does he know how to say the rosary? And they said, yes. He says, Okay, well, I'll ordain him. He says, I'll ordain him and the grace of God will do the rest. So on July 2nd, he was made a subdeacon, and on June 23rd, a deacon. Then on August 12th of the year 1815, around the same time as the Battle of Waterloo, he was ordained a priest at the age of 30. He was ordained in Grenoble. And what's interesting was the vicar sent him to back to Father Bally as Father Bally's associate pastor. See, a lot of people, some of them were opposed to the ordination of St. John Vianney because they felt he was so unlearned. And so basically they thought, well, Father Bally, you know, worked so hard to ordain him, let's send him back to Father Bally and see, give him what he deserves, in other words. Well, John Vianney was thrilled and Father Bally was thrilled. But, you know, because they were worried about John Vianney's education, he was not allowed to hear confessions for the first few months until they felt he had more education. So isn't that amazing? The patron saint of priests was not allowed to hear confessions for the first, it doesn't say exactly how long, maybe 3 months, maybe 6 months of his ordination. So eventually he was given faculties to be allowed to hear confessions, and the first one who went to confession to him was Father Bally. And then something, unfortunately, after two years of being with this holy priest, Father Bally died after having received the last rites and the sacraments from his young priest, St. John Vianney. So really, Father Bally, without him, we would not have the great St. John Vianney. And so Father Bally died on December 17th in the year 1817. So now, there was a question, what do we do next? What do we do now with John Vianney? The vicar and the bishop really didn't know what to do with him. And so they figured, well, they'll send him out as far away as possible so he'll do as little harm as possible. They sent him to a little town of Ars, which isn't even on my map here. But so on February 9th, 1818, he was sent and he walked out to this little village, walked for miles and miles until he found it. He got lost, which is very easy to do. It is a little bit tough to find. I was there a couple of years ago, and we had to stop and ask directions a few times to eventually get there. Well, on his way, he got lost, and he asked a young boy for directions. And it was just right outside the town, and the boy told him how to get there. And then he made an interesting point. He said, you have showed me how to get to Ars. I will now teach you how to get to heaven. And there's a statue, which I'll show you a picture of it, which is now, right as you enter Ars, of St. John Vianney pointing up to heaven and telling this young boy that you know, that he would help him get to heaven. And there was something interesting that happened with that young boy. John Vianney lived to be 73 years old. And from what I understand, that boy died as on the same day that St. John Vianney died. You know, a number of 41 years later. So the boy died when he was like in his 50s, but they died on the same day, so most likely entered heaven together on the same day. When John Vianney saw Ars, he got down on his knees and he prayed to the guardian angel of Ars. And he was sort of given an inspiration, a prophecy. He said, I see that sometime in the future, Ars will not be big enough to hold all the multitude of pilgrims that will come to visit this place. And so John Vianney entered there in 1818, and he would spend the rest of his life, 41 years, there. Now, Ars was a very small town. Again, they sent him out to do as little damage as possible. There was only 40 houses in the whole town, 230 souls. That included children. And what he found there was that Ars was not a very sinful place. It was not a really decadent place. It was just lukewarm and indifferent. And there was, you know, a lot of drinking and dancing and gossiping. And when he was sent there, the vicar told him, I'm sending you to a place where there is not much love of God, but you must put some there. You must put some love of God there. So he began by fasting, spending many hours each day in prayer, doing a lot of penance, visiting the homes of the people, teaching the catechism. And in 41 years, it said he converted 80,000 hardened sinners. And each year, by the end of his life, each year, 100,000 to 120,000 pilgrims would come to see him. Isn't that amazing? This little tiny town of ours soon became really the most popular pilgrimage spot in all of France. So when he got to Ars, his prayer was, God, grant me the conversion of my parish. I consent to suffer all you wish for the entirety of my life if you'll give me the conversion of this parish. So he began by preaching, establishing guilds, and he was able to stop blasphemy. He was able to close down all the taverns after a good number of years. Some of them were very upset, you know, from losing the business, but Jean Vianney was able to, on a few occasions, raise enough money to buy, you know, sort of buy the tavern, and then the owner of the tavern would go off and start another kind of business. And after 8 years, it took him 8 years to be able to stop people from working on Sundays and conducting business on Sundays as if it were any other day. And it took him 25 years to abolish dancing and to establish modesty in Ars. So one of his main apostolates really was the confessional. And people would come eventually after they realized that they had a saint as a priest, people would come from all over France. And so during the winter times, he would hear confessions from an average of 11 to 12 hours each day. And during the summer, as many as 16 hours a day he would spend in the confessional. He was called the martyr of the confessional. And the way he would do this, he had two different confessionals, one for the men, one for the women, and he would devote a certain number of hours to hearing the men's confessions, a certain number of hours for the women's confessionals. And of course it was really no heat and no air conditioning, as you know, and so it really was a kind of a martyrdom to spend this many hours sitting on this hard wooden bench. I've had the privilege of visiting Ars and sitting in the confessional of Jean Vianney, and I think to sit there for an hour would be a lot. Imagine sitting there for 16 hours a day. Well, some of the crosses that he experienced at this time were much calumny and misunderstanding, physical exhaustion. In the early days, for the first 8 or 9 years that he was there, he did a lot of severe penance. Later on, he would call some of it, what he said, the folly of his youth, because he would sleep on the floor, he would scourge himself to bleeding, he would wear pointy chains around his waist, you know, chains with sharp points, and his health eventually broke down after 8 or 9 years, and he eased up on his penances a little bit. Even though in the confessional he always gave very easy penances to the penitents, and the priest once asked him, and Jean Vianney says, I give them easy penances and then I perform the rest of their penance myself, which was interesting. Well, even despite all the many crosses and the difficulties he had, he would never complain about these things. He even prayed for a great love of the cross. And his diet was rather interesting. Every week he would boil up 7 potatoes, and he would eat 1 potato a day. Some days he would eat 2 potatoes, but he never ate more than that because he figured that would be sort of gluttonous to eat for that 3rd potato. So that's all he ate, and the devil hated him for it, and the devil, you know, Jean Vianney called the devil Grappin as his nickname for him. And on one occasion, on a number of occasions, he would hear the devil speaking to him. And he would say, Vianney, Vianney, you potato eater. I shall get thee all right. And so Jean Vianney had many fights with the devil, and I'll mention a little bit more about that in a moment or two. Another thing that Jean Vianney would sometimes cook for himself, besides the potatoes, were what he called hunger killers, which were like muffins or pancakes, just flour and water and a little bit of salt. And he would fry these on the grill. And he said this would stop his hunger. On a rare treat, he would have an egg that he would cook for himself. But imagine the the penance that this priest was doing for the conversion of his parish. Sometimes people say, well, how did he do at his preaching and things like that? Because if he was so unlearned, how could he function? Well, actually, he was a very intelligent person. He just had a difficulty with Latin, but he knew the Latin of the Mass perfectly. And I've seen his library. He had hundreds and literally thousands of good books. And he would spend the rest of his life, 41 years, reading and studying. He would study sacred scripture. He studied the Catechism of the Council of Trent. He studied the lives of the saints. He knew the lives of hundreds of saints. He would study dogma, moral theology, the liturgy. So he actually became quite learned, even though in his early days in the seminary he had a difficult time. One of the things that he started at the in Ars was called La Providence, which was a free school for girls and for orphans. And he had two women that helped him start this. One was named Catherine Lasagna. Isn't that a great name? Probably pronounced Catherine Lasagne, but spelled like lasagna. And Benedicta Lardet. And it was very interesting because Gianviani would, oftentimes, they ran out of food and he was completely trusting to divine providence. That's why he called it La Providence. And oftentimes they'd run out of food and Gianviani would have to go over and he'd only have like a little bowl of grain left and Gianviani would bless it and put it inside a little, inside the closet, and then a few hours later he'd open it up and whole grain would just pour out of the closet. There are many occasions where he worked miracles of multiplying food and multiplying the grain. Sometimes he would be asked to go and preach missions in other parishes. And one pastor once said that Gianviani was his favorite missionary because he worked himself to death and he ate nothing. So he didn't cost the parish anything, but he did such a great job hearing confessions. But when he was back in Ars, he would spend his weekdays going around visiting the farms and cottages of the people. And he would always go around lunchtime, but he would never eat with the people. But he would go visit them. He would sort of stand in the door, watch them eat, and he would talk to them about the farming and about the animals. Since he had a background in farming and animals, people really liked him for that. But before he would leave, he would give them a little blessing and say a few words about heaven or about Jesus or about seeing them in church on Sundays. This is how he helped to convert the people. And then during the afternoons, he would often be seen walking through the fields, praying his rosary, reading his breviary, and greeting the farmers along the way. Just a kind word, a cheerful word. And he only had one cassock. He had one hat and one pair of heavy walking shoes, and he really wore those out after so many years. Now, it's interesting. Let me just read a couple paragraphs from the life of St. Gianviani, because a few interesting things happened at this time. One was that the next-door neighbor, who was actually the priest in the next parish over, sent Gianviani a letter. And he said, Monsieur Curé, when a man knows as little theology as you do, I'd suggest he not go into the confessional. And Gianviani replied back, most dear and most venerated confrère, what good reasons I have for loving you. You are the only person who really knows me. Since you are so kind and so good as to take an interest in my poor soul, do help me to obtain the favor for which I have been asking for so long a time, that being released from a post which I am not worthy to hold by reason of my ignorance, I may be allowed to retire into a little corner there to weep over my poor life. What penances there are to be undertaken, how many expiations to be offered, how many tears to be shed. But when the priest received that letter, he was touched. His heart was touched, and he walked on foot, and he knelt down before Gianviani and asked forgiveness for writing such a letter. On another occasion, a petition was circulated among Vianney's fellow priests, accusing him of sentimentalism, sensationalism, ignorance, and ostentatiousness and for doing too much penance. As it was addressed to all the clergy, John Vianney got a hold of it. He read it and he signed it himself. And basically was asking for his release from the parish, because John Vianney's always had a desire to become a Cistercian or a Carthusian, and later on he would try actually to leave, and he fled at night. He would leave Ars at night, but the people, the little old ladies, would keep a lookout out their window, and if they saw him flee, they would ring the bell, the town bell, and the men would go out and get him. Sometimes they would even steal his breviary so he couldn't get away, because they knew he wouldn't leave without his breviary, without the divine office. So in three separate times, he tried to escape Ars and become a monk, but they wouldn't let him do it. On one time, he was at a priest retreat, and the bishop, a lot of priests were complaining about John Vianney, and he says, "I wish all of you had a little bit of Vianney's madness." That's what the bishop told the priest. Now, another interesting thing was his daily schedule. Says he would begin the day, it says, it is a simple fact that he hardly ever slept. He began the day by taking his lantern through the sleepy crowd. See, at this time, people were gathered in the church all, 24 hours a day. And he would take his lantern through the sleepy crowd to begin his prayers at 1 o'clock in the morning. So his day began at 1 o'clock in the morning. The curé was punctual about this. From then until 6, when he celebrated Mass, he heard the women's confessions. So from 1 in the morning to 6, the women's confessions. And then he said Mass. After that, from 6 to 8, following his private acts of thanksgiving, he mingled with the pilgrims, blessing medals and chatting freely. Then he crossed the square to La Providence, to the girls' school, for a half a cup of milk. That was his breakfast and lunch. Nuns were living in community in Ars in the later years, and he was able to use this time to talk with them. The men's confessions would begin at 8:30 in the morning in another confessional, a rather crude wooden confessional set up in the sacristy. So after he heard their confessions, then there was a break in the daily schedule at 10 for prayers and then more confessions, until 11 when he returned to La Providence for the catechism, which ended with the noonday Angelus. So every day he would teach the children the catechism. It took 15 minutes to get through the crowded square back to the presbytery to eat what he called lunch, namely a potato, standing all the while and talking to visitors. Abbe Monin, who was one of his biographers, says he never sat down before anyone else and never let anyone stand out of respect to him except during the liturgy. The conversation during lunch was usually well animated, with the curé telling most of the jokes. Then at 12:30, a large group escorted him to sick calls. So imagine that. He would then take Holy Communion to the sick, and a whole group of people would just follow him. This was a trying time, as more than a few took the opportunity to snatch pieces of his clothing. Some of them would come with scissors, and he'd be walking through the crowds, and people would try to snip a piece of his hair, snip some of his cassock. The poor guy, would... And then it says, when someone produced a pair of scissors to snip some of his hair for a souvenir, he stared meekly, but afterward confessed that he nearly boxed his ears. After Vespers and Compline, he heard women's confessions until 5, and then the men until 8. Then he climbed the pulpit to lead evening prayers in the rosary. Sometimes more confessions and special conferences followed. He had no time for committees and never took a day off. The bishop would not permit the curé to go on retreat, despite his pleadings. The bishop, possibly with imprudence, insisted that a retreat would be superfluous. The curé never left the church before 10, and sometimes remained until midnight. He was back at the stroke of 1. This meant he slept 2 hours at most before beginning a new day. And he did this 7 days a week for 30 years. So again, he lived to be, 73 years old, and the doctors said they don't know how he did it.
Are they eating a potato a day, sometimes two potatoes a day, a half a glass of milk? And he did this, you know, 41 years in ours. And it's really a miracle of how he kept alive. So just a fascinating saint, as you can tell. So a few other interesting things. As far as his homilies go, as a young priest, he would spend hours and hours reading and writing out his homilies, sometimes 30 or 40 pages worth, and then he would try to memorize it. But oftentimes he couldn't remember it, and during his homilies he would just forget his place, and he would just stop and sit down out of embarrassment. Later on, as his schedule became so busy, he didn't have time for a lot of preparation, but he would make a novena to the Holy Spirit, and they say these were his best homilies. You know, it's interesting that back in those days, a lot of people would come, especially the men, when they came to church. You know, the homilies were quite long, and so people would use it as a time to sleep. They figured they would just sleep during the homily. John Vianney didn't like that. So he would shout his homily so loud and with such a screeching voice that the men couldn't sleep during his homilies. He once said that the biggest sin he felt in ours was ignorance. And that he says that was the root cause of all the immorality. So he began to educate people as much as he could. He worked especially trying to stop people from blaspheming, from taking God's name in vain. He once said he didn't know how people would not be struck dead when they used God's name in vain. That was his own personal opinion. He just, it baffled him why the people would not be struck dead when they used God's name in vain. He put a stop to immodest songs and conversations. As I mentioned, he closed down the taverns. He stopped work on Sundays. And he did away with the immoral dancing that was going on. And the one way he did this, in the church, he had a statue, like a shrine set up to St. John the Baptist. And he put a sign over that which said, "His head was the price of a dance." Remember that with Herod and Salome? And that gets the point across. It's like the people who leave church early. You know, in some churches they have a sign saying, you know, remember it was Judas who was the only one who left the Last Supper early. It gets people's attention. Well, he really promoted the keeping of the Ten Commandments, and he told people he wasn't asking for much, just that people kept the Ten Commandments and would keep the six precepts of the church and do the duties of their state in life. Once he was asked by a person how to save one's soul, and you know what he said? He said, "Keep the commandments of God and the commandments of the church and avoid the seven deadly sins." If you do that, you'll be saved. Keep the commandments of God, the commandments of the church, and avoid the seven deadly sins. So he would teach people through his homilies. He would sometimes preach sermons that would be an hour long. He would often lose his voice by the end of the sermons from shouting so much. On one occasion, an interesting thing happened. A woman came to him in despair because her husband had jumped off a bridge and committed suicide. And John Vianney prayed for a few moments, and he was given an inner revelation that he told the woman, "Your husband has been saved. Your husband is saved." Before he hit the ground, he made an act of contrition. And this was revealed to him by God. And so it's actually comforting to know that in God's grace, you know, he can work, even if it seems a person died in a very unfortunate way, maybe a suicide, that God's grace perhaps could have converted the person at the last moment. One of his special loves was teaching the children. He would teach the children the catechism each day. He would teach them the rosary. He always carried his rosary with him. He would teach the lives of the saints. And he became such a well-known preacher that the famous Father Lacordaire, the famous Jesuit, came to hear him. Lacordaire was the priest at Notre Dame in Paris, and he came out and was very impressed with St. John Vianney. In the year 1846, St. John Vianney became a Third Order Franciscan. Any Third Order Franciscans here? This is a Carmelite parish, that's right. A lot of Carmelites. And Father Rutler says, you know, for John Vianney to become a Third Order Franciscan would be like George Washington applying for U.S. citizenship. Interesting point. John Vianney promoted the Blessed Sacrament, devotion to our Lord and the Eucharist, promoted Eucharistic guilds, and pretty soon the church was never empty. There was one fellow that would always be praying in the church, and John Vianney asked him, because he would see this man praying for hours, for all day, just in the presence of the Blessed Sacrament, and he asked the fellow, "What do you say to Jesus when you're praying?" He says, "I just look at Jesus, and Jesus looks at me." And John Vianney would often quote that in his homilies as really the epitome of prayer, looking at Jesus and Jesus looking at us. His great desire was that the church would become a shrine. And so he enlarged the sanctuary. He brought in beautiful statues and pictures, the best that money could buy. He himself had no money, but there was one wealthy widow in the town who would buy him vestments and chalices, and the statues would be ordered. And he established side chapels to the Blessed Mother, to St. John the Baptist, to St. Philomena, to the Passion of Christ, and to the Holy Angels. So he's very big into religious art, and everything is in excellent taste. If you go to ours, you'll see the same statues that he bought, just beautiful statues. The parish that he was in was the parish dedicated to Pope Sixtus the Martyr. I want to mention something else about his, before we take our break, I want to mention something else about the harassment that he received from the devil. He once said that wherever God builds a church, Satan pitches a tent across the street. On many occasions, John Vianney was dragged out of bed by his ankles by Satan. People heard screams coming from his house, not his screams, but the screams of the devil. Sometimes the devil would come through his bedroom which shook, because it felt like there was like a dozen horses running through his bedroom. So from the years 1824 to 1858, hundreds of times a year, he would be attacked by the devil. And at the beginning, he was very sort of shaken by this, but towards the end of his life, he sort of laughed and would joke and sort of tease the devil. The devil would also try to hurt him in other ways, but for example, one occasion there was a young fellow that was studying for the priesthood that came to see John Vianney, and the young man knelt down on John Vianney's prie-dieu to go to confession, and as soon as he did, the whole room shook and the prie-dieu shook, and this fellow turned white. He was scared to death, and John Vianney says, "Oh, that's nothing, that's just Grappin, that's just the devil." And then he told the young man, "You really have to become a priest. Apparently the devil is not too happy that you're studying for the priesthood." And the young man eventually became a priest, but he says he never went to confession to John Vianney again. He didn't like the shaking prie-dieu. By the year 1827, John Vianney's, the church was just packed with pilgrims. As I mentioned, 100,000 pilgrims a year were coming. And an interesting thing happened in 1854 that was really probably the highlight of his life. It was December 8, 1854, the dogma of the Immaculate Conception was defined. And John Vianney was just thrilled because, of course, he and the church had always believed in the Immaculate Conception, but when it officially became defined, John Vianney had beautiful processions and mass where he wore his best vestments, that it was really his happiest day. Another interesting thing was all the miracles that occurred, that people would come and oftentimes be cured physically, and people began to really attribute these to him, but he said no. He says all these miracles are through the intercession of Saint Philomena. He had a special relationship with Saint Philomena because her relics had just been discovered in 1802 in Rome in the catacombs on May 24th, 1802, She was a virgin martyr who was killed during the persecution of Diocletian in the year 304 after having been tortured. And John Vianney had a great devotion to Saint Philomena. She says, there was a special brother-sister bond between the two of them. It was like between Francis and Claire, between Benedict and Scholastica, between Francis de Sales and Jane Francis de Chantel. There's a spiritual bond between him and St. Philomena. So when anyone ever had a miracle, he always said it was because of St. Philomena. So he worked very closely with her. That was his sort of spiritual sister. During this time, nuns and brother priests and bishops would even line up to try just to even catch a few words of advice from him. For example, if a bishop came up to him, he might just say something like, love your priest. You know, the bishop sometimes would have to wait for hours to speak with him. And oftentimes, during these 16 hours a day that he was hearing confessions, people would be waiting in line, sometimes for 3 or 4 days, to go to confession to him. And there was one woman there who got very upset. And he says, Madame, you are not a very patient person. You've only been waiting here for 3 days. He says, you'll have to stay 15 days. And she did. Other occasions, you know, John Vianney could read souls. So oftentimes somebody would come to confession. For example, one man, this was interesting, one man was sitting out in the church, and John Vianney pointed him out and called him aside. And he says, I think you should go to confession. And the man says, well, it's been 30 years. And John Vianney says, actually, it's been 33 years. And the last time you went was at such and such a church, such and such a town. Well, that man went to confession. After 20 minutes, he came out a new man. Sometimes John Vianney would weep in the confessionals, and somebody once asked him, why do you weep for my sins? He says, I weep because you do not weep for your sins. Once there was a woman who was waiting in line, and John Vianney just sort of cut in front of the whole line. He just walked out of the confessional, went over to her and said, you can go to confession now. And so she went to confession. She says, how did you know I really needed to go? She says, he said, I know, you're the mother of 16 children. So she had made this pilgrimage to go to confession, and John Vianney knew she had to get back to take care of her children. So he could read souls in the confessional. Well, he died, he collapsed on the 29th of July, 1859, and he died on August 4th of 1859 after being given the last rites at age 73. His body was buried there at the church, and then it was exhumed in the year 1904. So that's about 50 years later, and it was incorrupt. Did you know that the body of St. John Vianney has never decayed? It's incorrupt. His body was, when it was exhumed, his heart was perfectly intact. His body was dried and darkened, but still perfectly intact. Then he was beatified in 1905 by St. Pius X, and then canonized in 1925 by Pope Pius XI. And in 1929, he was declared the patron saint of parish priests. And he's the only diocesan priest that's ever been canonized, okay? So it's much easier to become a saint being married or being single than it is to be one of us, parish priests. That's why you have to pray a lot for parish priests. He's the only one in 2,000 years that's a canonized saint. So he's been declared the patron saint of parish priests. So we'll stop there, and then after our break, we'll come back and have your questions and comments. Before I answer some questions, I have a relic here of St. John Vianney, and so maybe I'll give you a blessing now with it, and then I'll pass it around and you can venerate it. Through the intercession of St. John Vianney, may Almighty God bless you, the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. Amen. So I'll pass that around. Also, I want to point out a couple books about John Vianney. This book is called The Cure of Ars by Father Bartholomew O'Brien. It's published by Tan, It's only about $5. I'd highly recommend this one if you're interested in just sort of a short life of the saint. He's in the back, has pictures of what ours looks like, what the basilica, an aerial view of ours, the inside of the church, and even has pictures of all four of the chapels, of the Blessed Virgin, John the Baptist, and St. Philomena. This shows the women's confessional, and this shows the men's confessional. The men were, hear confessions of the men in the sacristy, and the women out in the church in the confessional. This shows the side altar where he's now buried, where his incorrupt body is buried. The picture I gave you, you'll see what it looks like, and I had the privilege of saying Mass there right at that altar, and he's just a few feet buried right above the altar. And usually they'll even let you put on his vestments and use his chalice, which is a great privilege. Now his body's incorrupt, he's a very short person, and there's a wax mask over his face, but everything else, but he is incorrupt. And then his heart is in a separate church, which is actually on the same property, but it's in the Chapel of the Heart, which is just outside the main church, sort of maybe 20 yards around to the back of the church. And there you can go and kneel down and pray before the heart of John Vianney. Also, we'll have, these are photographs of his kitchen where he would boil his potatoes. And this is a picture of his bedroom later in life. And then a picture of his library. Again, he had literally hundreds and hundreds of books. And then there's a large basilica that's been built there now on ours that can actually hold, I think, 4,000 people. And it's a lower crypt. And this is where Pope John Paul II went and gave a priest retreat. So I want to pass this around because you can, a lot of good pictures in this book. Also, if he's mentioned here in the book called The Incorruptibles, this is an excellent book. This is Mary Fabian Windeout's book on the Curia of Ars for children, but I've read it and it's an excellent book, and I think adults could, you know, can get a great deal out of it as well. And this book I read a number of years ago by Henri Guillaume, which is called The Secret of the Curia of Ars. It's out of print, but if you ever find it at a yard sale or a used bookstore, I highly recommend it. This is The Curia of Ars Today by Father Rutler. Some of you know of Father Rutler from Mother Angelica. He's done series on Mother Angelica quite a bit. And this is sort of written in the style that a G.K. Chesterton book is written. A lot of commentary. It's not your typical biography of John Vianney. It's a lot of his own reflections on sort of the state of the church in France, and very deep sort of philosophical book, but also I think very readable. And this, if you really like John Vianney, if you want to read a 600-page book about him, read Abbé Trochu's book. This is really considered the definitive work on the life of St. John Vianney. Okay, time for your questions. Okay.
Why did you schedule the women's and the men's separately for confession at different times?
Okay, the question is, I'll repeat it for the sake of the tape. Why did he schedule the women and the men's confession at separate times? You know, it's really hard to say. I think he did it for a few reasons. One is that, you know, since people would sometimes have to wait, you know, sometimes 3 or 4 days in line, you know, they would probably just sort of sleep there too. They'd fall asleep and not lose their place. So I think he did it for that reason. Also, maybe so the men wouldn't be distracted, and maybe so the women wouldn't be distracted. Just like they used to have all boys schools and all girls schools. And a lot of people, I went to an all boys school from second grade to 12th grade, so for 10 years. And there is a great deal of a benefit in that way. And a lot of people who have gone to either an all-boys school or all-girls school say you can sort of focus on your studies and there's just less distractions. So I think he did it for that reason as well. He's pretty wise, pretty smart. Somebody also asked about psychological reason of how he could only sleep for 2 hours a night and still function. Well, of course, the Holy Father, they say, only sleeps for maybe 3 to 5 hours a night. That's what I've heard. And I think it's that he sort of lives on grace. I think some of these really holy saints sort of are given so much grace that they're able to function with 2 hours. I don't think any of us could, really. Really. Okay, other questions? Okay, the question is, what about the flagellations? What about the what looks like harming one's body? Doesn't that violate the teachings of the church on respecting one's body? And, for example, self-mutilation of cutting off a hand or a foot, you know, doing something deliberately to hurt yourself, or bungee jumping or things like that. That wouldn't necessarily be a sin, but you know, some people have said it is. If it's not done in a safe environment, if you're putting yourself in danger, it would be. If it's tested and if it's all safe, then you know that would be, you know, acceptable. But the question is, well, what about this? And see, mortification or self-discipline is certainly recommended and allowed by the church. It's where it comes to harming one's own health. And Giovanni even later admitted that he called it the folly of his youth, where he did do perhaps too much physical penance to himself. But fasting is something very good and holy, and mortification and depriving oneself of certain things, of chocolate chip cookies and of other things, is certainly a good and praiseworthy thing. So, in moderation, penance is good and these things are beneficial. However, if it hurts one's health, the church would say, no, that's too much, and you really need the advice of a spiritual director to help you be temperate in that. See, in our day and age, a lot of Catholics, it's just the opposite. They're not doing any penance. You know, once they gave up, or once they stopped not eating meat on Fridays, whereas, as you know, Friday is still a day of penance, and we should still do some sacrifice. If we do choose to eat meat on Friday, we're required to make some other sacrifice and give up something else. So the way I would look at that question would be that the flagellation and things like that today would not be recommended by the church. As far as harming one's body, the church would not want us to do that. However, to do acts of mortification in a very moderate way are very highly recommended. So I would say that a person could do penance and that kind of self-discipline to get their passions under control and things like that, whereas they should not harm their health. Other questions? Right, yeah, the question is about closing down the taverns and things. In fact, I remember one incident where there's somebody that was producing immodest pictures, and Giovanni put a stop to that, and the fellow said he's going to go out of, I guess it was maybe playing cards was what he was doing, and with different pictures on it, and Giovanni was able to stop that, and the fellow was losing his business. But Giovanni says, why don't you make holy cards of the saints instead? And the man did, and his business was successful, and he made even more money with the holy cards than he did with the playing cards. But as far as the question of drink, obviously we know that the church says that drink in moderation is fine. To have a glass of wine or a beer is certainly fine. But apparently the taverns in those days were places of a lot of gossip and a lot of fighting and brawls, and there were places where a lot of drunkenness would be rampant. So he was really fighting against the abuse and of the drunkenness. But he basically felt that people shouldn't be doing those things at all, even the dancing and the drinking and, of course, the gossip. And so he was able to get rid of those completely. Whereas we do know that in moderation, a glass of wine or a beer or those things would be acceptable, provided that they're not occasions of sin for people. And apparently the kind of dancing that they were doing was causing sin, you know, sinful thoughts, So he got rid of that. See, Kelly. This book on the incorruptibles lists, I think, 105 saints whose bodies are incorrupt, and a lot of them are there. Some of them are in different states of incorruptibility. Some of them are really perfect looking, like Bernadette and Catherine Laboureille, whereas other, and John Vianney looks pretty decent too, even though he does have the wax mask. Some of them aren't quite as well preserved. So, but in this book it just lists those that are incorrupt, and I guess there are different degrees of incorruptibility. I'm not sure if that answered the question you were looking for. Pardon? Okay, the question is why some saints are incorruptible and some others aren't. See, not all saints are incorrupt. 99% of the saints are not incorrupt. And only 1 or 2% are incorrupt. And it's hard to say why God preserves some saints and not others. People have tried to figure out, is it just the ones that the Blessed Mother appeared to, like Bernadette and Catherine? But that's not the case, because other saints have corrupted. I believe Juan Diego and others have corrupted, even though Jacinta, I believe, in Francisco are incorrupt, which is interesting. And Lucia is still alive, so she's still incorrupt. Even though she's like 90 years old, so she's starting to decay a little bit, I think. But why certain saints and not others? It's really God's choice that for some reason he preserves some saints and not others. It's a good question, and there's really, I've never heard a good answer of why some are corrupt and some are incorrupt. Okay, other questions?
Did they put the mask on St. John Vianney because the wax mask, because his face was decaying?
Yeah, well, it's not so much decaying, but that it had sort of dried up and that it was very darkened. And so I guess if pilgrims go and they see it very dark, and they might freak them out a little bit. So they put a wax mask to make it a little bit more attractive, a little bit more appealing. Here's a photograph of the bed that the devil set on fire, and a photograph of his bedroom, or actually the bed in which he died. He rarely slept in that bed. And here's his cassock and his hat. And his vestments, his beautiful vestments. Like I mentioned, that wealthy woman bought him beautiful vestments. So when it came to the church, he always wanted the best statues and the best things for God, but for himself, he lived a life of quite severe poverty. Okay, other questions? Anybody else? A picture of the underground crypt church, which seats like 4,000. And then here is the little chapel. This is the chapel of the heart. And you can see the statue of John Vianney. So you can come up and look at these afterwards if you'd like. Any other questions? Yeah. So the question is, why was he baptized on the same day as his birth? It was pretty common practice that a child would be baptized within the first few days of birth, usually within the first 3 days or within the first week of birth. So that was sort of a common practice back then. And so, but as far as I know, there wasn't any other, for example, revelation to the parents that they should have him baptized on the same day. It was just a common practice. You had a baby, he had it baptized, because infant deaths were quite common back then, and they wanted to make sure the baby was baptized. It's a good question.
Even in the 1900s, they baptized early. I was baptized 10 days after I was born.
Wow.
Because there was an influenza epidemic
yeah.
in the country, and they got me up to the church outside.
Very good. Now, I was baptized 9 days after I was born.
3 days.
Do I hear two? Do I hear one? 3 days. 2 days. Anybody on their... Anybody? Very good. Any last questions? Other questions? Well, and what's your question?
To this day, people who commit suicide have been
No. Now, let me repeat the question for the sake of the tape. The question is, what about a suicide case? Now, John Vianney didn't say it was okay, to go commit suicide. It's just on this particular case of this man who did throw himself off a bridge, God revealed to John Vianney in a special locution or revelation for the comfort of the widow that this man was given the grace of an act of perfect contrition before his death. Now, it is the case that even if somebody has committed suicide, you could still have a mass for them. They can still be buried in church property. Now, in the past, that wasn't the case, but with a more deep understanding of psychology and a realization that people who do these things, perhaps, or some of them might not be culpable for their actions through this, because of despair or a number of other mental illnesses, that perhaps, God would take that into consideration and they could be saved. Objectively, it's a serious sin. Subjectively, we don't know what the state of the person's mind, heart, and soul was right before death. So that's why we do give them a Catholic burial. Yes. Right, only very few priests have ever had that grace to be able to read souls. Christ the High Priest had it. Padre Pio, John Vianney. There's just very few others that have the ability to read souls. It's not a very common gift. Yeah, why the devil visited him so often was because there was no other way the devil could get him. Like, he can tempt all of us in other ways, But John Vianney, because he wouldn't sleep, because he wouldn't eat, because because he was just so holy, the devil had to resort to physical attacks on him. And that's happened in the lives of many of the saints. Because the devil couldn't get him through ordinary temptations. And again, that quotation, if there were three such priests as him, the devil admitted that his kingdom would be ruined. Yeah. That is true. And somebody had also asked about why there's not many diocesan priests canonized. And basically, it's because it's usually a religious order that promotes the cause. If a Jesuit dies, the Jesuits would promote the cause. If a Dominican dies, the Dominicans would promote it. So they have a whole, ability to promote devotion to that saint throughout the whole church. Whereas a parish priest, usually there's not a whole sort of a worldwide movement. Most priests are never even heard of outside their own parish. Or their own diocese. Now, I think Bishop Sheen, God willing, will be canonized. I really hope he is. My mom was his secretary for 4 years, back in when he was a Monsignor teaching philosophy at Catholic U. So we have a number of his autographs and books that he signed for her. So Bishop Sheen, I think, will be one who will be a canonized saint, God willing. But again, he was a bishop as far as ordinary parish priest. John Vianney is the only one.